Welcome to the BizNews Power Hour, where we give you the rational perspective on business news that matters.
I'm Nadja Swart here with my colleague Justin Rowe Roberts, and we have an excellent show coming up this evening in which Alec Hogg speaks to Patrick Melly of the Greater Cape Town Civic Alliance to unpack where in the process the Western Cape is to get independence from the rest of South Africa. You'll also be hearing from Capitec's Chief Executive Officer, Gerry Fourie, who's going to talk about the benefits that Capitec customers receive from Capitec's Dis-Chem and Baby City partnership. Fourie will also unpack Capitec's partnership with SA Home Loans and the aftermath of South Africa's Week of Shame. Then my BizNews colleague, Justin, will be speaking to Small Talk Daily's analyst, Anthony Clark, about independent school network Curro to discuss the reasons for Curro's drop in headline earnings, as well as the prospects of the business going forward. Then as our guest commentator this evening, we'll have Magnus Haystack of Brenthurst Wealth Management. But first, here are the news headlines.
BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets mean change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
New names have emerged as candidates for the cabinet as President Cyril Ramaphosa continues consultations to shore up his executive. According to Business Day, the matter was discussed but not finalized by the ANC top leadership on Monday, but the tripartite alliance, which includes COSATU and the SA Communist Party, has not yet been consulted. Staff in the presidency have said that some ministers have been asked to prepare handover reports. Among the names being considered is former Deputy Finance Minister Mondli Gungubele as minister in the presidency and Limpopo Health MEC Pofi Ramatuba and Deputy Health Minister Joe Fala for the health portfolio. While there is a push from within the government for Fala to take over the health department, Ramatuba has surpassed expectations in terms of the vaccine rollout in Limpopo. Gungubele is an ANC veteran with the close confidence of Ramaphosa. Eskom has said that it is seeking to appoint advisors on how to restructure itself into three separate units, a reorganization that was proposed to let it better deal with an untenable debt burden. The separation of the Johannesburg-based company into transmission, generation and distribution units was first raised by President Cyril Ramaphosa more than 2 years ago. The company has since reduced its liabilities but is still struggling to manage almost 400 billion rand in debt and has subjected the country to intermittent power cuts since 2005. The so-called request for proposals is in addition to an earlier notice seeking advisors on how to fund the closing and repurposing of a number of the company's coal-fired power stations into sites that could generate electricity from natural gas or renewable resources. The National Prosecuting Authority has raised alarm about former President Jacob Zuma's latest bid for a corruption trial acquittal being heard in court, weeks after his imprisonment for contempt of court was followed by unrest that left hundreds of people dead and cost billions of rands in damage. The former president's lawyers have, however, told the Pietermaritzburg High Court that he refuses to consent to what they contend would be an unconstitutional and illegal virtual hearing of his special plea application. The NPA says there is no reason to risk security or COVID-19 infection by holding the hearing in person, but says the case must go on no matter what, in person or not. Zuma's special plea is for the entire case to be dropped and for him to be acquitted of all charges because he claims the NPA is biased against him. Justin, what's been going on in the markets?
Thanks, Nods. The JSE All Share Index was flat at 68,800. In the currency markets, the rand strengthened against all the major currencies to 14 rand 40 cents to the dollar, 20 rand and 10 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 11 cents to the euro. Gold is down at $1,808 an ounce. Kruger Rand will cost you around 28,000 Rand. Brent crude is lower at $72.60 a barrel. And Bitcoin is also down at 550,000 Rand per coin. Tencent led a stocks rout after Chinese state media decried the spiritual opium of games, prompting the company to broach a ban for kids and triggering fears Beijing will set its next sights on the world's largest gaming arena. Tencent fell as much as 10% before finishing that day just over 5% lower. On the JSE, Naspers and Prosus followed lower by a similar percentage. High school education provider Curro announced that headline earnings per share, the primary indicator of performance for JSE-listed businesses, will fall by around 50% against the prior period. Curragh's 1.5 billion rand rights issue in 2020, creating more shares in issue, was the primary driver for lower earnings per share. The shares down around 5% on the news. Precious metals provider Royal Bafokeng Platinum announced record interim numbers for its half-year financials. Despite strong performance, the commodity counter missed expectations, with the share falling sharply, around 7% for the day, whilst other precious metals producers were slightly down on lower commodity prices.
This market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Magnus Haystack has shifted from his usual Wednesday slot with us, but it's a good day to do it because, my goodness, there's a lot to talk about. Starting off with Naspers. You've been amongst those who've been warning us that Naspers is such a huge part of retirement portfolios in South Africa. And lo and behold, the Beijing government this morning started calling Tencent, or its major part of its business, opium for the mind. Now, anyone who knows a little bit about Chinese history will realize that that's a massive insult given the opium wars between China and Britain and the reason why they occurred and the harm that still exists within China or distaste about that, because it made a lot of people into opium addicts. So if you've got your central government calling a side of your business opium for the mind, or spiritual opium, as it's also was also described, not surprising to see Tencent share price take a 10% hit.
It seems like the Chinese government is talking in code to its people and to the markets by throwing in words like opium. I mean, I would imagine that in the South African context, if you use the word apartheid and you use that in a statement about a company or a person, it evokes the same kind of reaction, and it has a very sinister overturn for the tech companies, and especially Nasdaq, because you have to be a specialist in Chinese communication. What are they trying to say? Because it is a statement, and it follows a sequence of attacks on companies in the tech space. I tried to explain to someone last week about a Chinese company in the education space, which had a $100 billion market cap, or $100 billion market cap, the one day and the next day it was worth zero. One can see that, you know, it's not a joke that possibly, as Pete Villeno asks and Sean Pichet, a Nasdaq or Tencent can be worth zero. And what does that do to trillions of rands in various investments, pension funds, RAs, And Naspers and process, it's, there must be a strategy behind it. The government, the Chinese government must be playing a game and they want something out of it. But what it is right now, I really do not know. I would imagine that Chris Becker and his people are trying to decipher this and having chats with the Chinese government. What do you want? What is it what you want to say? And what can we do to alleviate the pressure? But it is having an impact on the JSE with its heavy weighting, and the old saying in investment markets, risk is not a factor until it is a factor. And now in the case of Naspers, it is a factor.
And those VIEs as well. Suddenly there's a focus on the reality that you don't own a share of Tencent, the company. You own a share of the cash flows through a contract, which the Chinese government has said before is an illegal contract, something that comes through the Cayman Islands. So the risk is very, very high, not just to Tencent's operating businesses, but also to shareholders in the company. You've got to wonder what Naspers executives are saying to themselves now. They must be kicking themselves and saying, if only we had unbundled these Tencent shares, in the same way as, I suppose, many South African investors would be saying, if only we'd sold our Naspers shares when we saw the Chinese government starting to go after capitalists almost a year ago.
If only, Alec, we have done a lot of things in our life and we had known what markets would do. We would be extremely rich, comfortable, but we don't. We don't know this. And I think it is not a story that seems to be going away suddenly. Because it's not only a South African thing. As I said to you last week, I was watching the many programs on Bloomberg, CNBC, discussing American analysts trying to decipher what the Chinese are doing. And I think Naspers and Bob von Dijk and those people are having very intense discussions with their Chinese counterparts. What exactly does it mean? But the share price is already telling us something. It's down about 30 to 40% from its various peaks, both process and Naspers. And we as a company, although we don't directly deal in direct shares, we have been inundated with our clients asking us what to do with Naspers. And at this point in time, we tell them, we don't know. We simply don't know whether that's good or bad. We're trying to decipher it ourselves, and we're actually trying to, you know, have a Zoom meeting with Piet van Leeuwen and playing the interview that you did with him last week, which was very powerful. We're actually sending it to our clients and say, listen, see what Piet van Leeuwen has been saying and doing, and even that's not clear cut. So that makes markets, and that keeps us busy, Alec, and keeps us employed.
Yeah, I can tell you our biggest story by some distance this morning is Pitt's article that he wrote for us, particularly on the whole Naspers process issue. There's fair warning there. We move on to other issues, though, and something else which is very much in the news in our community is the whole story of Cape Independence. Magnus, where do you stand on this? Because I spoke to another person today, and we're going to be having that interview a little later in the program, Patrick Melly, and he is with the Cape Independence Movement. There seem to be a whole bunch of them. And just as a little voorsmaakie, he says that the Freedom Front Plus is in favor now, officially, of Cape Independence, which is the first political party outside of the Little Cape Party, which never really had any seats, to have stood or put their stake in the ground. What do you think about all this?
Well, Alec, I happen to be down in the Cape at the moment. I'm at Valdevie, where I have my little apartment. And I've been talking to a couple of people on the ground in the gym this morning, and I was chatting to Rack Netlin. And the hotel next to Valdevie is empty this time of the year. It is chock-a-block of people who have flown down to come and look at property. And it's all around them. Wherever you speak, they're just saying, people are selling up in the north, whether it's KwaZulu-Natal, Pretoria, Johannesburg. They are looking at the Western Cape and probably the Southern Cape as an alternative. Whether it politically will be able to separate and become an independent state, I don't think will happen. But I think there might be pressure to give it far more federal powers to run their own affairs independently, perhaps raise some taxes, which it can control, because again, in the South African context, where can it end up, or with the central government losing control over many, many functions of government? So there's a very strong emotional feeling about, yes, we want to be independent. One has to be a bit more careful. We are codependent on each other, but there are guys who give you very strong and cogent arguments that South Africa in 1910 wasn't a coherent country in any way, and that's where our problem started, and that it should have broken up a long time ago with greater elements of federalism, like in Switzerland. That might happen, Alec. At some point, there'll be so much pressure on the ANC or whichever government is still in power that the Cape is just going to say, we're going to break away, even if you don't want to break away. It could be very, very interesting politically as far as that's concerned.
Certainly the feedback from the Cape, and I'm sure you've been hearing a lot of this as well, is that with the looting and the riots that went on in KwaZulu-Natal, there just is no desire whatsoever to be paying for those kind of bills, which may not be the last time that we see that, given the inability of the Zulu police to stop other Zulu people from doing the kind of things that they did in the month of July.
Yeah, I think the low-level intensity uprising that we've been seeing for a couple of years have just escalated to a new high level. I think it's going to happen again sporadically, because I think disaffected communities have seen this is how you get reaction from government. So I think one can expect more of this happening in highly populated areas close to major cities, because the blueprint has been laid down, has been designed. That's how you almost force government to the table. You disrupt the traffic, the flow of food, the flow of fuel, and the harbors and a couple of strategic points, you know, airport or two station, and you effectively paralyze a country or a region or a city by doing a couple of things. So this is by no means the last of this uprising. And as we said last time, government has shown itself to be totally incapable with the buses and the trains in the Western Cape, the taxi shootings, the burning of our trucks of Moira all these years. And we've seen it in Klerksdorp, Lichtenburg, those areas, when the local communities, as a consequence of infrastructural collapse, cannot speak to people in power. They start uprisings, they start burning stuff, and that gets the reaction from the politicians.
I guess the issue here, and it goes back to a book that I read some years ago by Moises Naim, The End of Power, it was called, where he then forecast, he used to be the Venezuelan Minister of Industry. He then went over and works in a think tank in Washington. And he forecast then that through technology, we are going to get smaller and smaller within our areas of competence, and that states have to become smaller, because it's impossible to manage such huge tracts of land or geographically dispersed areas as South Africa is. And you wonder if in 1910 you'd said to the people there that in 100 years' time you will still be together, and there would be a very different scenario if they would then have voted as they did for the Union of South Africa, if they might not have asked for a very different get-together, a federation perhaps like in Canada, rather than the union that we saw in South Africa, I suppose in a way imposed on the people at the time by the British colonialists.
Well, if you go back in history, and we're going back very far back in the history books and to my high school years, if you read about the internal politics in South Africa around 1910 and even in 1948, I mean, the internal fights within the, let's call it the Afrikaans political parties, was how much control, centralized control or not, or should the provinces have more federal powers? And you had Yannie Smuts versus the Hofmeyrs. And even in those years, we have these debates about to what extent should the power come from the center, like from Pretoria. And as you said, it's a very, very large country. And I know that Hofmeyr was in favor of greater federal powers, all the various provinces, and in the end it cost him his job and he was booted. So it's a new debate in a new shape, but much more urgent than 50 or 60 years ago.
Another story that is occupying our minds in this evening's program is the rise and rise of Capitec. Interesting to see, and we'll be talking with Gerry Fourie, the chief executive, about this in a moment, that they now driving into the loyalty area where they announced yesterday that if you go into Dischem or I think it's called Baby City and you give a Capitec card, you automatically, without signing up for anything, you automatically get a 2% cash back. They've got a similar thing going with Shell as well. So real simple, a Capitec approach. But that is an organization that seems to have found a solution where others have been struggling in many, many areas.
Well, our large traditional banks still have the overhang of large and physical networks, lots of investment in buildings and branches and people behind the tellers. And here you have a relatively new bank. I think it's 20 years old now, around about 20 years old, when it listed at 50 cents, 2002. You know, slap your face, if only we knew. Come with a new model. It's like you have a fleet of 1,000, and here comes Uber with a totally model, an app on a cell phone that people could not even dream of that you could use in the same type of business. And that's what rejuvenates business all the time. You get very smart people, and they bring technologies from an entirely, totally different space. And there you go. They changed the rules of the game. And Capitec has done it. And there's so many other examples that we've seen around the world in Israel, Switzerland, and particularly in the United States. You must know that if you start a business or you have a dominant market position in the United States, there are 10 other guys trying to break down your business model and come with a newer and a better and a more efficient model. That is the history of capitalism, and we now see it with Capitec doing that to the local or the traditional banks.
Competition works, and it works for all. Magnus Haystack, we'll be back again next week on Wednesday, though. Harry Faree joins us, Chief Executive of Capitec. I asked if we could have a chat because of the acceleration now of your loyalty program. We've seen many other financial institutions doing that discovery with their shared value model. You seem to be ratcheting it up now. We do know about Shell that you get 20 cents off per liter if you use your Capitec card. You don't have to sign up with anything. But now you've expanded that into Dis-Chem, which I think has got quite a number of other partners, financial services partners as well. Where's this going, this whole loyalty program of yours?
Yeah, well, we don't see it as a loyalty program because we actually hate loyalty programs because I think they overcomplicate it and a very small portion of people are actually really understanding it and really using it. So what we're doing is to actually bringing out a benefits program whereby, again, true to Capitec, everyone is treated exactly the same. So there's no difference. You get exactly the same benefit as what I'm getting. And the second thing is to make it very simplistic. We've created a separate savings account, which we call Live Better. So all the money that you earn through the benefits goes into your savings account, and you earn extra interest rates on that. So it's the first steps. We've signed up about 1.6 million clients in about 2 to 3 weeks. Your rounding, you can, whenever you swipe your card, there's a rounding functionality as well as interest. You move your interest into this Live Better account. So it's part of the journey that we're starting to go on to.
And you've only, you said a couple of months that you've had this 1.6 million clients. I suppose it shows the scale of Capitec nowadays.
Yeah, it's about 3-4 weeks, and we just marketed to our internal clients, or clients that's on the app. So if you open the app, you'll see Live Better, and it's amazing. The payouts that we've done so far is over 13 million. So yeah, I think there's a nice acceptance, and I think now Shell one of these days will also be paid into this account. And then there's a couple of other, there's smaller players that's partnering with ourselves. But the whole purpose is that if you swipe, you get X percent off and that X percent goes into this Live Better account. So it's a very simplistic manner to reward people whenever they use the Capitec card.
So there's no sign-ups, no selecting which retailer. Do you have, obviously, Dis-Chem and Baby City, that's the latest announcement that you've got, or your press release yesterday said that you'll get 2% cash back on those two. Do you have other retailers?
Not other retailers. There's about 3 or 4 that's very close to starting. It will start before the end of the year. But then there's a couple of smaller companies that we're also working with, and that's currently there. I think the one that's that we had very good success was with Greyhound. Unfortunately, they closed down. But when you swipe, you got a 15% discount. We've got Hello Doctor that you get a certain discount. There's a lot of educational programs that you get about 30-40% off if you sign on to these education programs. So there's quite a wide variety of programs. But like I said, we're in the beginning phases. And we'll definitely grow it in the next couple of months and probably years.
I know from visiting with you and seeing how you guys have grown over the past couple of decades that you've been really focused on data. Is that what informs your decision on who to partner with? In other words, Shell rather than, say, Engen. Was it because Capitec clients were more involved at Shell, or do you start at the top and start negotiating down?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. We've got very good understanding of where our clients swap. That helps us to go to that particular retailer and say, this is the current swaps, Capitec swaps at your stores, and then to look at what business proposition we can get from. And then the other ones is who wants to partner with us? You know, it's a, I think a very attractive option. We're sitting with 16.4 million clients and 16.4 million clients that we can talk directly to. So I think it's a big opportunity for retailers to direct these clients to their stores or to their offers. So I think it's going to be quite exciting.
Yeah. We haven't had a chance to pick up yet, together on what happened in KwaZulu-Natal. How many ATMs did you lose were literally pulled out of the wall, as we saw many of those pictures on social media?
Yeah, we lost about 70 branches, and then we've lost about 280 ATMs. And of the 70 branches, 60 of them was completely destroyed. So we need to really rebuild them from scratch. On average, a branch takes 6 to 8 weeks to rebuild. So you can do the sums. It will take us a good 6 to 7 to 8 months to rebuild. And then there's about 10, 11 branches where the buildings that they are housed are structurally unsafe. So we first need to get engineers up, to make certain that we can, rebuild. Maybe the buildings need to be demolished or something else needs to be done. And those branches will take 12 to 18 months.
Just explain that. They're structurally unsafe now. What did the looters do to put the buildings in those states?
Well, if you look at some of our ATMs were bombed to get to the cash. And if you look at a
bombed.
Bomb, yeah, because there's the ATM. They've got the ATM out. There's two ways to get to the ATM. You either grind it open or you bomb it. And if you bomb it, it's got damage to the buildings. So it's actually quite scary to what they've done. It's not the major shopping malls. It's the smaller ones that they've destroyed to a certain event.
What do you mean by a bomb? Like something from the military?
Dynamite. Where do you get that? Your explosive.
And it didn't damage the ATM sufficiently to get rid of all the cash. But don't you guys have some kind of a spray that you can't use the cash in the ATM?
Yeah, you've got dye stain in. So if you bomb it, then it dye the notes. And you've probably seen or heard in the newspapers, there's a lot of dye notes that's in circulation. And it's coming from the different banks, because all the banks are using dye stain.
So that's really dumb. You're going to go and blow up an ATM. Yeah. Perhaps you cause a lot of damage. You get the notes out, but they all died. So you can't use them.
Yeah, 100%.
Or are people actually accepting those notes?
No. You will maybe get away at a retailer if it's slightly died, or somebody, you give it to a friend or something like that. But when you bring it into a bank, we won't accept it.
So, Harry, what happens now to the cost of all of this? It sounds like it's a big number for Capitec.
Yeah, you know, luckily you're covered by Sasria.
Are you? Last we looked at Sasria, they only had 6 billion rand in their accounts. Most of the money had been moved off to government years ago. And the numbers that were being bandied around, certainly just for KZN, was 20 billion. So yeah. Surely there'll be a big knock there.
Yeah, I think that's where we worked very closely with the Minister of Finance and said you need to support Sasria. That's why the government has given the undertaking that they will support, because we need, forget about the banks, we need to get all businesses up as quickly as possible. So you need to make certain that the claims are processed very quickly and that the people get their money and that they can really start. So I think we're quite fine from this unrest, but I think if there's a second wave or a third wave, because you're depleting Sasria's funds, then it's going to be quite interesting. So I think that's going to be challenging to look at that.
You're comfortable that everybody who had a business that was damaged by the riots and the looting is going to be refunded through Sasria, which itself is going to maybe claw back some of that 50 billion rand that government took, which was 20 years ago, because we were supposed to be a democracy and not have riots anymore. But you're warning that if it happens again, watch out.
If I look at surveys that was done by the banks, about 20, let's say plus minus 90 to 95% of the people has got Sasria cover. And I'm talking about the formal sector. I'm not talking about the informal sector. I think the majority will be fine. It's a matter now of going through the claims and pay it out as quickly as possible. I'm concerned if there's a second or third unrest, because then Sasria is depleted.
And the shopping centres where your branches, when you say they've been put out of service, what exactly happened? Because presumably the thieves weren't able to get into safes where the money is kept.
No, but they destroyed everything. And I took a lot of the TV screens and computer screens. I can actually not do anything with it because it's only a screen. Because the computers are working from head office. It's not working from the branch itself. But yeah, everything was taken and literally destroyed. There's nothing left of a branch. So you basically, yeah, you were rebuilding everything. The furniture was demolished. The back office was demolished. The control centers were demolished. So it's quite sad to see.
You're listening to the BizNews Power Hour, brought to you by the team at biznews.com.
Patrick Melly joins us now. He is with the Cape Independence Movement. Patrick, we've spoken to quite a few people about the proposed independence of the Western Cape, and I'd be very interested to try and find out who sits where. Now, there is, for instance, Hein Marks, who's from the United Liberty Alliance. Have they got anything to do with you?
I am in contact with him, and I do work with him, but I also work with quite a few other people as well. So, you know, we all tend to varying degrees work with each other, and but the big thing is we have a different approaches to the whole idea of Cape independence. You know, there's some people who believe in a referendum should be held. Others don't believe a referendum is necessary and so on. And so, yeah, as I said, there are different approaches by different people.
And then Phil Craig, is he part of your organization? Because he's also
I am in communication with him quite frequently.
So why don't you guys all get together and speak with one voice?
Well, as I said, you know, there are different approaches, and we are moving to a situation whereby we basically sort of coalescing into two distinct groups, and the one group consists of those people who would like a referendum, and the other group is those people who prefer not to have a referendum and prefer to pursue other means, legal means, of course. You know, everybody, this is one thing, everybody is agreed on one thing. Whatever we do must be legal.
Let's just find out a little bit more about the Cape Independence Movement. How big are you? What constituency do you have?
Well, we don't have a very big membership because we are not, we're more of an advocacy group than anything else. So we are more relying more upon other groups and organizations to do a lot of the work.
Okay, so what is it that you do?
Well, what we do is we try to influence people. We talk to people, we talk to groups, etc., and promoting the idea of Cape independence.
On what purpose? What's your argument?
Well, the argument is that, number one, we want to retain the Western Cape as a first world society. And, you know, let's be honest, the rest of South Africa can no longer be called a first world society, if ever it could be called a first world society. Things are disintegrating, and you know, we all know that services are very bad in other parts of the country. You know, the proverbial potholes are not filled and the robots don't work and all the rest of it. We hear about, you know, hospitals being in a bad state and administration is bad, and there's loads and loads of corruption, and we don't really have all those issues down here in the Cape, and we want to retain it that way. We don't want to see it go the same way as the rest of South Africa.
But surely the rest of South Africa could only improve from the very low base that it's at now, particularly after the awful month of July.
Yeah, but how long is it going to take? Is it going to take 50 years, 100 years? you know, what are you doing in the meantime?
Well, okay. So your philosophy is the Western Cape is a well-governed, great place. You don't want it to get contaminated. Am I reading you correctly?
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Are you economically, or the research that your Cape independence movement has done, are you economically sustainable in the Western Cape without the rest of South Africa?
Well, you know, there are two ways to approach this. First of all, if you look at what is happening in the rest of South Africa, how viable is the rest of South Africa going to be? If you are a minority businessman, how are you going to ensure that your business survives? Quite apart from all the riots that we've had recently, have a look at all the restrictions and all the laws and regulations, etc., that the ANC has come up with over the years and is coming up with more and more every year. You know, it's South Africa is no longer the wonderful place to do business in anymore. Whereas the Western Cape is a good place to do business in. And this is the reason why so many business people have already relocated from, let us say, Gauteng to the Western Cape. Now, obviously, not all businesses can relocate. But those who can relocate, quite a few of them have already done so, and others are contemplating making the move.
You do know that South Africa relies heavily on mining, and there aren't too many mines in the area that you're looking at, and that's really what I'm getting at. What would the Western Cape economy look like?
Now, when we talk about the Cape, the Western Cape, we shouldn't just be looking at the Western Cape, although initially we're talking about the Western Cape, but if ultimately we're talking about a much bigger area, which would incorporate parts of the Northern Cape and possibly even adjacent areas in the Eastern Cape. And as you know, there are a lot of mineral resources in the Northern Cape, which could be and those areas where they are found could easily be incorporated into an expanded Cape.
But why wouldn't they rather go to Namibia? Why would they want to side with you? They could, if they were to break away, why wouldn't they go to Namibia, which is also an independent option? There are lots of different hurdles.
Historically, they are part of the Cape.
Okay.
You know, the so-called Northern Cape is just a political invention that they came along in 1994. Before 1994, there was no such province as the Northern Cape. It was part and parcel of the Cape. And those people still, in many ways, feel that they are part of the Cape.
So
they don't feel part of Namibia. Coming back to the mineral resources, you know, let us not forget that there is a potential of huge oil deposits, oil and gas deposits off the west coast and off the south coast. And and if these deposits are ultimately exploited, they could be of enormous financial benefit to an independent Western Cape.
But they would also be of enormous financial benefit to South Africa, which would make your journey to independence presumably a lot more difficult if you are even more valuable to the central government. So I'm just trying to understand how you would achieve this.
We are working on plans, and we will be announcing them before the end of the year.
Plans based on a legal route to independence for the Western Cape?
Based on a legal route to independence, yes.
On South African law, on the Constitution?
Well, we'll also be relying upon international law too.
It's very similar to what Hein Marx was saying at the United Liberty Alliance, that he was wanting, or he believes that international law says if one other country accepts your independence, then legally you can go ahead with it. It sounds a rather flimsy argument, but is it one that you've also based yours on?
Yes, but I think we can go a little bit further than that. You know, the thing is that you, if you are going to rely, you know, upon substantial international support right at the beginning, you are going to have a bit of a problem. But at some stage, you know, one is going to have to take up the attitude, present everybody with a fait accompli.
And the riots and looting of the past month, has that seen a strengthening of your resolve in the independence movement?
Absolutely. The feeling is that the riots that occurred last month are just a precursor to worse that is still to come. And, you know, there is a feeling that the ANC is going to split and it's going to be a bit of a violent split, and it's going to impact upon the country very dramatically. And we would prefer to be quarantined from all that chaos that's going to result from the ANC splitting up and just the general deterioration in the country.
I'm Justin Rowe Roberts of BizNews, and with me today is Anthony Clark, better known as Small Talk Daily on social media and a veteran JSE small and mid-cap analyst. Anthony, before we get into the nitty-gritty of Curro's trading statement, can you provide some background on Curro, the service it offers, and its target market within the higher education space?
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for the opportunity. It's nice to be on BizNews. Curro is probably one of the oldest established private schools in the country. There's only basically two or three. For many, many years, it was Advertech, which is best known for its high-end schools, such as Crawford College. There's some private interests like Redden, which are, again, very well known. And probably about 15 years ago, PSG Group, having met the founder of Curro Holdings, a gentleman called Dr. Chris van der Merwe, who was operating a small school in Durbanville, in a church, basically saw the potential of affordable private schooling for the masses. So PSG, I'm probably going back now at least 10 or 12 years, paid 50 million rand for a 50% stake of Curro Holdings. And at that stage, they only had three schools and a few thousand learners. As it stands here today, we have a market capitalization of some 7 billion rand. PSG remained the dominant shareholder. And we have about 66,000 learners across 200 separate schools in the country, showing you that the development of private education in this country, the affordable space, and when I say affordable, they have different categories ranging from 1,500 rand a month up to 8,000 rand a month. There remains a consistent demand for private quality education, given the fact the state system isn't as good as it used to be.
Onto the trading statement, the company reported a reasonable significant drop in headline earnings versus the prior period, with headline earnings being the primary indicator of performance for JSE-listed counters. The market has reacted negatively to the announcement, with the share down around 4% today. Can you delve into the numbers in further detail and to whether the market is looking too much into the drop in earnings?
Yeah, again, I saw the trading statement this morning. I read it. It's incredibly detailed, which I expected it to be. You know, the share price, as you said, at one point, the stock was down about 6%. It's now down about 4.3% to 11 Rand 20. To me, it came as no surprise. You know, the small to mid-cap space is generally characterized by a lack of information to the wider audience. So you physically actually have to delve a lot deeper into the underlying narrative of a company to ascertain what's going on. And in Curro's case, I've been the prime analyst of that stock since even before it was founded, because it was an asset hidden inside PSG, which I've covered for 20 years. And then every company every year has an annual general meeting where shareholders and analysts and anyone has the right to ask questions as to how the business was doing. The company generally puts out a trading update or an update on the preceding events, and that information is available on their website. In this year's AGM, which happened, I think, in mid-June from memory, which I participated in, nothing that was detailed in today's trading statement is new. They indicated that there's been issues with bad and doubtful debts. They indicated that COVID from last year to this year has caused significant disruption and costs to their business. As one would imagine, you know, children are not going to school, they're working from home. And a significant part of Curro's revenue and additional profits comes from providing ancillary services, aftercare, bus services, hostel accommodation, etc., etc. So children are not at school, they aren't using those services, which means they've lost about 300 million rand during the course of a year. The other big issue is, in August last year, Curro had a very large rights issue to raise 1.5 billion rand to help repay a huge debt pile which it had built up over the years. So on a like-for-like basis, a significant proportion of this HEPS downgrade is because there are 45% more shares in issue in this period compared to last year, and we've had COVID, and the schools have restarted again, and then we've had further lockdowns, as you know, which has impacted the entire schooling sector. So this to me is not unsurprising, and it was all detailed in the pre-statement and at the AGM. But the market being the market, once they see something in black and white, they say, oh, there's a shock, not realizing that this news literally came out, on the 22nd of June. There we are. If you knew where to look, you could find it.
And Anthony, educational technology is one of the niche disruptive industries that has been accelerated due to the onset of COVID-19. Do you believe Curro will be on the forefront of disruption within the higher education space, specifically in South Africa, and this creating a competitive advantage for the business going forward?
Yes, I think most of the private schools, I know that Advertech, Redham and Curro Holdings have all issued their learners with tablets or PCs and or, you know, the varying bandwidth and Wi-Fi connections to enable the learners during this difficult period to actually continue their studies at home. And there will always be an element who will not wish to go back to school. They'll be very happy learning at home. But again, we forget that school is not just about learning. It's physically about engaging with other learners. It's building social networks. It's building friends. It's the basis of your entire life ahead of you. So if you're just stuck at home, learning from a book or online, the very interpersonal skills that you would learn from school, discipline, for example, friendships, and all the nuances that goes with a young person's life is lost. So I think going forward, I see online learning as being far more prevalent in what I would call the tertiary space, where you finished your school, you're considering going to university or to a college, and perhaps you don't want to go to, you know, to WITS or UCT or Stellenbosch or whatever, and you decide to do your course online and maybe occasionally go into varsity a couple of days a week. So the likes of a Stadio, which has an online offering, where over 80% of their 36,000 learners learn online. So I'd say it's more prevalent in the tertiary space, not in the primary or secondary space, where I think there's still a need for engagement physically with an educator, and of course the social experience of being at school and playing rugby and going swimming, etc., etc.
And since listing, there's been a lot of excitement in PSG-backed Curro, but the company has struggled to live up to these expectations. The share price performance over the last few years is testament to that. What's gone wrong?
Your words are very kind. When Curro listed, it listed via an introduction on the Altex market at 4 rand a share. I remember it clearly. I was told by a couple of institutions when I pitched the offer to them, they physically kicked me out of a building, saying that at 4 rand it was overpriced and it was only worth 2. Within a matter of years, Curro's share price from a 4 rand listing hit an all-time high of nearly 60 rand. Sadly, about 4 to 5 years ago, a series of missteps inside Curro due to rapid expansion, them overpromising, a combination of factors led to a period of very disappointing results performances from Curro. And the share price, as you know, has sunk dramatically. At its lowest point during the COVID sell-off in March 2020, the share price hit a low from memory of 4.62. So it basically wiped out 10 years of capital growth. Now, in the last 12 months after COVID and the recovery in the economy and the market, we're now back to, as I said, 11.20. But again, just to compare, on a year-to-date basis, I checked before you came on, Curro year-to-date for 2021 is up 23%. Advertech is up 53%. It's had a far more resilient performance On a one-year basis, Curro is up 33%, which is not bad, but Advertech is up 196%, showing you the quality of earnings for us delivered by Advertech compared to Curro. And the market has rewarded the company by significantly increasing its share price because the earnings predictability and the underlying growth of the company has been significantly better than Curro. So as it stands right now, Curro, as I've written in many, many reports, if I was writing a report card, I'd say they must try harder and they wouldn't get a gold star next to their report. They might get a C+, whereas Advertech would get an A.
Today is Tuesday, August 3rd, and this is your FT News Briefing. North American wildfires are doing damage to companies' carbon emission goals, and Goldman Sachs is going to scale back on its gangbusters asset management business. Plus, the airline industry is surging back after getting hit hard by the pandemic, but are the good times here to stay?
One of the key questions really is going to be business travel. How much of those fly-in, fly-out trips are going to be replaced by virtual conferencing, which has worked so well during the crisis? And obviously, that will be a significant problem for airlines.
I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need. When it comes to fighting climate change, forests are important, not just because they absorb carbon dioxide, but also because big corporations buy forests to offset their own emissions to meet their net zero goals. But the recent wildfires in North America makes the reliability of this approach questionable. Just take two forestry projects bought by Microsoft and BP that recently set ablaze. The FT's Camilla Hodson says we might see more of this happen too.
This is something that people are really worried about. As climate change accelerates, wildfires are likely to become more common and also more intense in certain parts of the world. And that includes the west coast of the US, where quite a lot of offset projects are based. So the concern is that there'll be more forests that are burned, and that will mean that more offsetting projects are impacted.
So Camilla, have Microsoft and BP figured out what to do next?
No, I think it's quite early days still in terms of assessing the extent of the damage and what to do about it. I think it's worth mentioning that offsetting projects will contribute a proportion of the credits that they generate to something called a buffer pool, which kind of works like an insurance mechanism. And that means that in the case of a fire, or if a project for some other reason doesn't deliver all the carbon benefits that it claims that it will, then the credits that are in the buffer pool can be cancelled. For these two projects that have been impacted in the US, the concern there is that in the case of a really extreme fire, the buffer pool just might not be big enough to cover all of the damage, particularly if you're seeing damage across more than one project.
Buying forests and just offsetting in general are incredibly popular tools for companies that are trying to map out a net zero game plan. Will wildfires and climate change impact their approach?
Yeah, I think businesses are becoming more aware of the various pitfalls that are associated with offsetting. There's been a lot of criticism of offsetting in general over the years, not just because of things like wildfires or problems that can occur, but also more substantially about the kind of some of the fundamentals to do with how these projects are run and how you calculate carbon savings. So there is a lot of talk at the moment about how best to use them, when it's appropriate. People will say best practice is something along the lines of a company reduces emissions as much as it possibly can. And if there are some residual emissions that for some reason they just can't get rid of, then at that point, perhaps it's appropriate to buy offsets to compensate. But it's really an unregulated space at the moment. And that's not the format that all companies will be choosing to use. Some will be more strict about it than others.
Camilla Hodson is the FT's climate reporter. Goldman Sachs made a cool $5.1 billion off asset management last quarter, largely on the back of investments the bank made with its own capital. It was an all-time high for Goldman, but that might be as good as it gets for the bank for a while. Goldman is trying to scale back the investments it makes on its own by nearly 20%. Instead, it wants to earn more asset management fees by investing money for clients, such as pension funds and wealthy individuals. The move is meant to make two types of people happy: investors and regulators. Goldman hopes that these strategies will boost its stock price for investors and it hopes that it'll lower capital demands from regulators. That second one is a big one for Goldman. The Federal Reserve requires that Goldman hold a larger amount of capital relative to risk-weighted assets than other U.S. banks. The Delta variant of the coronavirus has led to a lot of restrictions being put back into place. Several states have introduced vaccine requirements for state employees, and other places have brought back rules regarding mask wearing. But the Delta variant hasn't dampened the enthusiasm of airline executives. If you remember, airlines were one of the worst sectors to be hit by the pandemic, but there's been a slow recovery going on in large parts of the industry. Philip Georgiadis is the FT's acting transport correspondent, and he's been talking to industry executives to gauge their level of optimism. He joins me now to discuss this. So, Philip, do we know how much airlines have lost since the pandemic more or less shut down international travel?
A lot. It's hard really to think of an industry that's been worse hit by the pandemic and all the travel restrictions. A ballpark figure would be roughly that global airlines lost about $125 billion US dollars last year, and they're estimated by their trade body IATA to be on track to lose about another 50 billion or so this year. So it's getting better, but still these are huge losses for an industry that suffers from a profitability problem under normal circumstances. But that outlook really differs around the world, largely from how strict the travel restrictions are and whether there's been a bit of a recovery in travel over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, let's talk about the recovery. Where are we seeing the most promising signs at the moment?
A lot of it is correlated around those countries that are fortunate enough to have high vaccination rates. And on top of that, strong domestic markets, which of course mean that people don't have to travel through borders when they fly. The US is leading the way. Its domestic market has really roared back this year. I was just looking through the data, and around 2 million passengers a day are going through US airports at the moment. And that's not far off 2019 levels. And the situation's also getting a little bit better in Europe. The EU in early July introduced a digital health pass, and that has led to a rebound in travel. When you speak to airlines such as Ryanair or EasyJet, they say they're really seeing a very strong recovery in Europe in short-haul leisure. Basically, people either taking a summer holiday or getting that trip in to see their family that they might have postponed for more than a year. There's a recovery of sorts in the UK, which hasn't been helped by ever-shifting travel rules. There are also expensive tests that people have to take whenever they come back into the UK. So people are beginning to travel, but it's a lot slower than in the European Union.
But what about long-term passenger demand? Do people in the industry believe that things will return to pre-pandemic levels once all travel restrictions are completely eased, or are they looking at something different here?
Well, for the last year, airline bosses have been insisting that the demand for travel will not be dimmed by the crisis. Once we're out of it, once those travel restrictions have gone, they insist things will snap back. And actually, they're quite excited by the fact that bookings are beginning to prove that. I suppose one of the key questions really is going to be business travel. How much of those fly-in, fly-out trips are going to be replaced by virtual conferencing, which has worked so well during the crisis? And obviously, that will be a significant problem for airlines if even a small chunk of that is lost because they're so profitable on that. CFOs are likely to be budget conscious, and companies are also increasingly aware of climate change. So there are a lot of questions for the industry, but at the moment I feel that executives will just hold on to any positivity and any signs of green shoots that they can find.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the post-pandemic industry. You know, that might be a long way off with the Delta variant, but you know, should that day come, what might airlines look like, Phil?
Well, I think it's hard to overestimate what a seismic shock this has been for the industry, its greatest ever crisis. So I suppose one of the key questions is going to be consolidation, particularly in Europe. Will the stronger players with the good balance sheet and low costs look to expand at the expense of their weaker rivals? And if you speak to someone like Michael O'Leary, the very bullish chief executive of Ryanair, he'll say that Europe will follow the US and you'll have consolidation and end up with four or five major players. I guess another question is profitability, because the industry has taken on a huge amount of debt and is going to have problems with balance sheets for some time to come.
Philip Georgiadis is the FT's acting transport correspondent. Thanks, Philip.
Thank you.
And before we go, El Salvador is set to become the first country in the world to allow Bitcoin to pay for everything. We mean everything. haircuts, taxes, grocery shopping. But the International Monetary Fund says there are concerns with a country using cryptocurrencies. The IMF wrote in a recent blog post that widespread use of cryptocurrencies would threaten macroeconomic stability. They also warned that crypto could harm a country's financial integrity because it's often used for shady activities. Now, the IMF didn't call out El Salvador by name in this blog post, but it is in talks with the country over a $1 billion loan. And this suggests that El Salvador's move to crypto could complicate things.
Thanks for being with us tonight. From me, Nadja Swart, and the Biz News team, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at Biz News.